Hey everyone, this is John Horsley, the creator and author of the Eyes Anthology, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
Our shenanigans are cruel and tragic, which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
All right. Hello, everybody. Hello, 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 hello. Welcome back to Verbal Shenanigans. I'm Scott. That's Mike over there in sweet Georgia. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing well, Scotty. Georgia's doing perfectly fine in our 60-70 degree weather, unlike you guys who were at negative like 2 at some point last week.
It was pretty tough last week, not gonna lie. Not very fun. Frozen shower. just very cold, but we're back. Today was beautiful. We're like in the 55-60 range. It was gorgeous, so we're okay.
Weather's on the ones here at Verbal Shenanigans.
And we recorded a week ahead of time, so it'll all make perfectly sense by the time this is released. But anyway, welcome to Verbal Shenanigans. We are a kind of like a radio type podcast that just simply tries to find interesting guests each week. And last week was no different. Last week, if you're just tuning in today, you got to go back to last week because we had the one and only Psycho Sid Udy, former WWF champion, former WCW champion. It turned out to be a very good interview. I didn't know where it was going at first because I called him and Mike is on the other line. And I did not know I hadn't conferenced in Mike yet. So I'm just staring at Mike's face on the laptop because we kind of have a video chat when we're doing it. And Sid is just going on and on. And he's talking about how much he loves the Vice TV network and do I like it. And he starts explaining all the shows he likes on the Vice network. And then he starts talking about, like, politics and Democrats and Republicans and how he doesn't care. And I'm just sitting there laughing, looking at Mike, thinking he's, like, hearing all this. And he didn't, but
meanwhile, I had my usual blank face, whether I know what I'm doing or not. So, you know,
right.
Very hard to Scotty mixed signals, if you will. So
Sid was, he was a little crazy at the beginning. He kind of seemed, you know, rambly, but then towards, I'd say right around like the 10-minute mark, he kind of settled in and we got to actually steer in some questions and get to where we wanted to go. And it turned out to be a fun interview.
Yeah, I think he figured out the vibe a good portion through and on. He was playing with us, and he was telling us some interesting stuff. He was even making a notion to his if you don't know about the famous Sid Vicious, Arn Anderson story, you might want to Google it. It's a fascinating game of rock, paper, scissors that had no rocks or paper involved, if you will.
Yeah, what was that? What was that over? They just hated each other?
I don't remember the full. I know they were on a European tour, and I don't think they were fond of each other, and they were going back and forth on things, and you know the alcohol was involved at the bar, and the guys like broke each other up, but one of them like broke down the other's hotel door and came after them with a scissor, and for what I recall, Anderson had about 15 stab wounds, and Sid had about 4 or 5 stab wounds, and it was a interesting predicament, and needless to say that Sid was away from the company after that, but apparently bygones can be bygones afterwards, so...
Stab wounds heal over time. But yeah, the Sid saga was funny for us, specifically me, because I've been, and I know I told it last week, but it's a little easier now to talk about it now it's out of the way. I had a long time ago just contacted his promo company or something. He had like a promo on Facebook, and I really didn't think anything of it. It looked kind of like, yeah, this is not anything. Look like just a crappy site. And the guy just says, yeah, try him at his try him at this number. He answers this line. And it turns out to be his home line. And I'm like, oh, all right. And I, you know, like, I get a little bit anxious just calling people out of the blue. I think it's just we get so used to technology on emailing and texting that just like calling someone and being like, hi, I'm Scott. I want to interview you. And, you know, but yeah, it wasn't a mobile phone. It was a landline. So
wow. They still exist.
They do. They do. Apparently in Arkansas. So I call him, and this has to be, I feel like, close to 3 or 4 months now, I would say, is a realistic length.
Yeah. It was – I know we were close in December because that was the night we almost had 4 interviews at the same evening that it kind of broke out. But I remember you texting me a little bit before, probably like in November, like, oh – you'll never guess who I might get, and you send a picture, and I'm like, oh, dang! It's like the classic verbal shenanigans, the hunt begins, if you will.
Exactly.
When you get excited for something, it always ends up being a 4 to 6 month process, minimum.
Correct. Some like Sean Kemp, who we've been trying to get on for about 4 years now, actually talked to him on the phone, had a couple of times scheduled, and then he just vanished off the face of the earth. Doesn't answer us at all. Lenny Dykstra was an interesting one. He said he would do it, and then randomly never got back to me. And then one day we had canceled guests. We're like, oh, what are we going to do? So we called up. We got Chips Cooney on, one of our comic friends. We're like, oh, it'll be a normal episode. And I just like, oh, out of curiosity, let's tweet at Lenny Dykstra. And I'm like, you want to come on tonight? But sure. And I'm like, no way. He calls me hammered from a plane, or what he said was a plane, probably the streets, probably the streets of Linden, New Jersey, not a plane. And we got him on. And then the Sid interview reminded me a little bit of the Lenny Dykstra interview, where we kind of just let it go. Just let him go. He was way more with it than Lenny, but
He was telling stories. He was, when we asked a question, he was directly answering a question.
Yep.
He at no point basically worried about the cops being around. So I recall you did not get into a yelling fight with a prostitute on the street.
Yes. So with that said, go back and listen to the Lenny Dykes episode for all those fun tidbits that were going on. Still
not to toot our own horn, but for our new listeners here, keep in mind we've had 1 World Series title on the show. We've had 4 Super Bowl rings with 2 guests on the show. We've had 1 Stanley Cup, 2 Stanley Cup titles with 2 different guests.
That's true.
Haven't got the NBA and 4-time WWE WCW champion, also a Daytona 500 champion, and also a Indy 500 winner,
and a mustache growing champion.
Yes, I'm sorry, I left the best for last.
How dare you?
Gandhi Jones.
You know, let's not stop there. We also had a Olympic gold medalist, the curler.
Yeah.
We've talked to a lot of people, and then we've also talked to a lot of athletes that were not champions, like Mo Vaughn and Kenny Anderson. But so we do like to kind of keep a nice little archival. But Sid will definitely he would definitely be one of the ones that we put on our letterheads and. Stuff that we talked to. A couple people reacted to me, like when I put it up, they're like, oh my God, like how did you get that? One guy messaged me, a little shout out to Tommy from the Pride Rules MMA podcast. I've called them a few times. He said that Chael Sonnen, famous fighter, has tried to get Sid on before, and Sid has told him, I don't want to do it. You're just wasting my time. I have no time for that. So, made me feel pretty good that I beat him into submission to finally do it.
Yeah.
Those people don't, like I was just saying, I talked to him at least 6 times, at least. And he'd be like, okay, just call me later at 6:30 or whatever. Call, no answer. Or call again. I'd be like, hey, Sid, you said we could do it next Monday. Oh, we're going to have to try next time. But. We finally got him, and that was last week, and it was entertaining for sure.
I got to say, though, I was looking forward to our plan of the weekly let's call Sid and see what happens on the podcast.
We were going to, and that's what's ironic, too. We were going to turn into a bit like, let's call. I could even put a song in there. Let's call Sid.
What will Sid do?
Sid won't answer. Maybe he will. Sid will like you, or maybe he'll kill. Sid is a guy that has a look in his eye that I don't even trust pissing him off from the other side of the United States. Like,
yeah, he does. Like, even like looking at his picture on Wikipedia, he has the, you know how some girls say they had the standing bitch face? He's got the standing I will murder you face.
Exactly. Like, he's definitely murdered before. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was last week, guys. So long story short, welcome to the show. Burrow, you coming down from the high from the Super Bowl?
Oh, yeah. That was, you know, everybody down here in Georgia is still talking about they just hosted the world's greatest sporting event to ever call in the existence of mankind.
Georgia.
I.e. the Slugfest 13-3 Patriots Parade.
Yep. So a couple takeaways. We won't get heavy into the sports part of it, but obviously the game wasn't super exciting. Defensive stronghold. Both defenses played really well. And, I mean, I just take away from it. I know that I am supposed – I've said this before. I'm supposed to hate the Patriots. I'm supposed to hate Brady. But it's just – simply amazing what Bill Belichick is able to draw up and just make a guy like Goff look like it was his first game in the NFL. He looked lost from the minute that game started. Just pressure was blowing. He couldn't find open receivers anywhere. And you never feel like the Patriots are out of it. They had 3 points. At one point, it felt like they were up by 20 because it was just that slow of a moving game. Like, no one was going to score.
Yeah, it was definitely a brutal one. Like, all the sports stations started to debate, is this the worst Super Bowl of all time? I'll flat out say I think it is.
Yep.
Here's my thought process on it. There's no passing touchdowns.
None.
The winning quarterback had more interceptions than touchdowns.
Yep.
I think the longest play was 27 yards, and for the life of me, I can't remember what it was. The one good hit of the game got a 15-yard penalty. That was the one where they did the screen to the running back, and he got smacked, and they're like, oh, he wasn't set.
Right.
So, it just dragged, and there was nothing about it. Even the one touchdown was a boring 2-yard up the gut thing where it's just – I guarantee you 5 years from now, I quiz you on this game, you won't be able to remember one thing about it other than it was atrocious. Yeah. The halftime show was just bland and just happened. The commercials outside of the NFL one, which I thought was fun, pretty much they were all bland and all trying the whole, oh, we'll get a celebrity on here, it'll be so kooky, and just everything about the whole night was just atrocious. So I'm just glad I didn't go out and spend hundreds of dollars on like food and drinks where I was just like saying, will you guys do something?
Yeah.
I'm just glad it happened. I'll give props to the Patriots. I think basically Julian Edelman just solidified he'll be a Hall of Famer just for a decent game.
Julian Edelman is like when you torture someone with 1,000 paper cuts. Like he just able to get short yard or whatever. Get open, get you that third down, you know, first down. Like he just is always, he's like a gnat. He doesn't go away. He's just very respectable. Like he's a guy that, like, you know, what is he, like 5'10", 5'9", something like that? He's tiny.
At best. I would have to Google it.
The Pats love, like, short, athletic white guys. Like, Wes Welker, him, you know.
Yeah. You got to sit back. The guy who made the biggest mistake after all this is Josh Gordon. He's sitting somewhere saying, I had to go get that pot.
Yep, yep.
I had to go get that. Because he probably would have eaten them alive if he played the game. But I don't know if he's still on the roster. Like, there was a debate on, does he get a Super Bowl ring? It's a question of if he's still on the roster or not.
He'll probably buy a good amount of pot for pointing a Super Bowl ring.
Yeah, there you go.
But the Josh Gordon thing,
the Super Bowl, but then I got high.
The Josh Gordon thing is a true case of like issues that are pretty relevant today that maybe shouldn't be issues. Like obviously we were very close. You know, I'd say within the next 5-10 years, marijuana is going to be legal through the entire country. And obviously this guy's got some mental health issues going on. Whether it's we don't really know exactly. We don't get a lot of the information, but he's had a lot of problems over the years, and you know, it makes you wonder if could he possibly using the pot to cope with some of his mental issues, which we know nowadays that pot really isn't like a big deal, you know, like, and it's like it's not a performance enhancing drug on the field. So I don't know. I'm curious to know what really goes on with that guy.
Well, and it's kind of a shame. I mean, him and I forget who the twin brothers. The one of them came from the Browns last year, so he went from 0-16 to a Super Bowl title, and Gordon could have went the same route. But I mean, all support for him, but he's definitely got some issues because they literally said the reason he got high was the Patriots had somebody on staff 24/7 to watch him, and he did it during the bye week.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, there's the problems of addiction and whatnot, but then you look at, you know, someone like Artie Lang, who's in the paper every freaking week with, you know, getting caught with coke and heroin, and just it's just a real sad, sad way to see him go.
You feel good. He's like, this is it. This is the long term goal I'm going down. And then the next day, it's like, well, yeah, because he got arrested again.
But touching back on the Super Bowl for a second, as far as commercials and the halftime thing, I really don't even care. I haven't for years about any of that. Once they started really going just like pop stars in the halftime show, like getting away from any rock bands, I really have not cared whatsoever. I kind of tune out at that time. We just like went to the little clubhouse that's up the street from us and then came back just the two of us at halftime. I think my fiance was asleep by 5 minutes into the third quarter. I was nodding off at the end of the third quarter. I woke up in the fourth like, oh, shit. Like, I missed 15 minutes of the game.
Didn't miss much.
All it ever is an artist doing medleys of their songs and then fake people jumping on the field, jumping up and down like they're at a concert. And it's pretty atrocious. I really don't care.
I mean, somebody said on the radio today, it was just a concert. It was a concert in between the two halves of the show. Like, if you look back at some of them, like when Michael Jackson did one of the Super Bowl shows, man, it was a full scene and theme. It was almost like a musical, and it was a play, and people are going nuts in the stands, and it's exciting. And pretty much where it all stems from was the stupid Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake thing, where it's like, oh, we saw a nipple, we gotta curtail this, and this, we gotta go, you know, very safe routes, and that's why all the shows are just I think the only last one I thought that was pretty decent was when Pink jumped off the top of the stadium. You remember that?
Yeah.
Was it Pink or Lady Gaga?
I don't know.
One of them jumped off the top of the stadium to come down, and they were singing. So, I mean, it's like, all right, you put effort into this. You didn't go out there and lip sync while you had a bunch of paid actors go to the 50-yard line and go, "Have you moved five?"
Yeah. I don't know. I get paid no mind to it. I don't even know who I would even want to see do a halftime show. I mean, I feel like the Foo Fighters would do an awesome job, but I know that
most older white guys are saying Metallica.
Metallica would
be
cool.
Even Metallica, it's like it's not like they're gonna thrash or anything. You know?
Yeah.
Are they 60s right now?
I mean, they still throw down pretty hard in concert, but yeah, they would just play whatever they're like. Four most popular songs and do a medley and whatever. To me, it's a bathroom break, get up and walk around kind of thing anyway. But yeah, so the Patriots are once again champions of the world, and it we'll probably never see anything like this again in our lifetime.
All right, Scotty, so who's winning the Daytona 500 next week?
Well, Trevor Bayne. Duh.
He doesn't have a ride.
He doesn't? He's out. He doesn't even have a sponsor anymore?
He has a sponsor. He doesn't have a ride. Nobody they basically let go of him from the sixth car, and he never picked up anything.
That's rough.
I know he looked for stuff. Yeah. It's hard. I mean, because you remember he won the Daytona 500, and then he had to go to the like the minors for about 3 years waiting for an opportunity. And that's the tough thing about racing. Yeah. You don't have the backing and the money and the owner. You're gone.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with the guy from Veedvergs. He's definitely going to win.
Yeah.
No, I'm my prediction, I'll go with one of the four racers I know. Martin Truex Jr. is going to win. Mark it
there
down.
There we go.
Mark it down. Mark it
and
down.
Joe Gibbs' car.
All right, Berlew. I think it is. I think it is officially guest time.
Oh, that's good to hear. Remember that time where we didn't go to the judges and make sure it was official, and then we got thrown off of podcast land for about 10 years?
I wonder if that podcast line is still running their podcast of the month that we tried desperately to win like five times.
I saw the site. It is up. It looked like it was down for a while. It was up. And when I tried to have it send me an email to do a vote, I never got the email.
Well, that's what they get.
I'm not 1,000% sure.
That's what they get for not allowing us to win. We were up by like a million votes that one time. And then the last day, someone came sweeping in and took us down, so we'll never be podcast of the month.
Our dreams are over, Scott.
And that's it.
It's time to call it a career.
But who we got
today? We're going to be talking with John Horsley. He's a an author, an artist, a podcaster, and he's going to be talking to us about his Kickstarter program for his upcoming book, The Ines Anthology, which is a horror sci-fi comic book novel.
All right, sounds good. So let's give John here a call.
Hello.
Hey, John.
Yeah, this is John.
John, how's it going? It's Scott and Mike from Verbal Shenanigans. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Doing pretty good.
That's awesome. You sound good. You sound nice and
thank you.
You sound nice and bassy. I like it.
Yeah, I use an ATR microphone. It's pretty awesome.
That's awesome. Mm. So,
John.
Go ahead, Mike.
Before we get into anything, one little weird thing I saw looking through your bio, I just want to confirm as we start off. Your legal first name is the letter J?
That is correct, yes.
Any particular reason why your parents didn't go on to a second letter?
It's a family name. It dates back to, like, four generations. I'm actually the third. My son is the fourth, so my grandfather was the first. He's named after his uncle, whose name was John, but he only went by Jay. So it kind of comes from my great-great uncle who dropped his name and went by letters.
Interesting, you know. Like, will future generations, will you go on to other letters of the alphabet, or you think you'll just stay with the letter J?
We'll just stick with J. I mean, my middle name's N, if that makes it better for you.
You don't like each generation doesn't just like get the next letter. Like your kid's name's not going to be K, right?
No. I have five kids, and one of them is J in the fourth. So,
wow.
So, John, thanks for giving us some time here and all. Why don't you tell our audience here a little bit about your background with being an author and with the project we were talking about, the Ines Anthology?
Sure. So a little background on me is I've been all things nerdy since I was a kid. Picked it up from my dad. My dad was really big into comics his whole life. At one point, he had amassed a Superman collection that had, you know, number 1 through 423 in it, but sold it off in the 80s. But I grew this love of comics. And horror specifically, because I always loved like the heavy metals and the epics of there, and like the Clive Barker Fright Night comics that came out in the 90s. And always loved the whole monster element. Like when I was a kid, that's my go-to drawing was to draw monsters or to draw some kind of weird messed up thing. So yeah. when it came time for me to like do something serious, monsters, but I got into comics, like drawing them before I started doing something serious. I was doing web comics, right? I did dick and fart joke web comics for 13 years online.
It's a very specific genre you chose. It is dick and fart, like, joke.
I like Kevin Smith films, so you know it goes from there. I mean, I literally got into doing web comics because I wanted to find a way to visually make fun of my friends in college. So I figured putting them in a web comic was the best way to do it. So that's what I did back in 2003. So I did that for 13 years. I created 11 different web comics of various genres and various art styles and types that I would write and draw, or write and somebody else would draw, or you know, various aspects I did on them. I've been writing short stories and poetry my entire life. Cool, just something I do for fun, my spare time. But in 2016, I decided I wanted to break away from the humor stuff, even though I was doing like more intellectual humor. And I say that very, very knowing how douchey that sounds.
Right.
You know, I was doing humor that had like more commentary on society in it by that time. I realized, you know, I want to kind of break away from the humor stuff and I want to do something that's a little more scary, because I like drawing – I've always drawn monsters or just like weird goblin-y, demon-y things. And that's when I started coming up with the idea for the Eyes Anthology, which basically started off my idea – or started off with me just looking around the web and seeing a bunch of really cool horror stuff coming out, like Ben Templesmith working on – and Steve Niles doing 30 Days a Night back in the early 2000s and like the Squitter stuff that Ben Templesmith does, and just seeing like – getting into authors like Richard Kadrey and the Sandman Slim series, just seeing all these cool – like not necessarily horror, but like horror things doing with supernatural stuff come out and diving into that world. And then I decided that, you know, the best way for me to do this is to fall back on something I love to do, which is to collaborate with people. And one of the most fun things for me is like to bring people into the things that I'm thinking about and like hear their thoughts and work with them to build a world and build like this story all together at once. And so my original idea for Eyes Anthology when I first started it was that honestly it was a little selfish. I wanted to stretch my muscles as an artist, so I was like, you know what, I'm gonna create a book, I'm gonna hire a bunch of authors, a bunch of writers to come in, work with me and build scripts and build these characters together. Because at the time I was doing this, I had already created a family tree of about 250 characters with names, wow, birthdays and death days dating back to like, I think the earliest one at that time was like 1540 all the way up to current times, a little bit in the future too. And I created like rules of the world, like, you know, like the quote unquote character Bible and story Bible for what the Ions anthology meant.
Right.
So I had like, this is what the Ions are, the Ions family, because the Ions is their last name, which I don't know if I said that yet or not, but it's their last name. And then I had the rules of the monsters. And like, they're very specific rules, but they allowed for a lot of interpretation. So my original idea was to bring on writers and say, okay, here's the rules of the world. Give me a time period somewhere in time you want to write in. Like if you want to write about World War One, or if you want to write about the Crusades, or you want to write about a spaceman in the future, let's see if we can work that time period in somewhere, and I'll give you characters that were alive in my family tree here for that time period, and we'll make it work with the overall story that I'm building. The only requirements are is you have to use a character from the family, and it has to be something that deals with the supernatural elements, you know, either psychological thriller with supernatural elements or monsters or something that crosses that horror line. And that was my only requirements for it, for the writers. So I put a post out on Facebook, and that post ended up generating like over 250 responses to me of people interested in the book. And that may have been because I ended it with, you will get paid for your script up front. Cause I realized, you know, as being the creator myself, you know, people want creators to come onto their book, like, oh, well, yeah, you get paid through a profit sharing if it gets funded on Kickstarter. And I don't want to do that. I mean, no, I don't want to talk bad of anybody who does that, because that's a valid way to make a Kickstarter.
Yep.
I wanted to pay people up front and be like, look, I value you as a creator, and I want you to know that I'm serious about this book, and I'm putting my money on the line beforehand, before we get to a finished product. So that probably had something to do with me getting so many responses, but it was good because I got a bunch of great authors come at me with scripts and with ideas and stuff. And I spent about 3 weeks or so reading through samples, reading through pitch ideas and stuff like that, and whittled that to 250 down to about 25. And I picked 25 because my original concept was to do 20 stories, in a 250-page book, and just kind of do a one-and-done anthology. Like, and it was going to be, you know, me doing all of the art. Right. So it was kind of be like a portfolio piece for me as well, but kind of this whole thing with this world as well. So I started working on that. I worked with the writers. We got scripts in. 25 turned to 22, then 22 turned to 32 because I lost some people, then gained new people, and we got all these amazing scripts in. I worked with every author at some just very lowly and some deeply to create their to fit within the world that I had created. And then I started drawing the first couple of pages and the first couple of stories, and I realized I am a married man with 5 kids and a full time job.
I'm
never going to finish this.
I would just say, hearing you talk about it, I'm getting anxiety about like how are you going to fit this all together. You know,
it wasn't working. So I was like, you know, do I want to make this a portfolio piece for me, or do I want to make this the best possible book it can be? And I chose to make it the best book I could be. So that meant I had to shell out more money, which was fine for me because I was like, you know what, I have time. I'm not going to rush this. I'm going to find artists that I think can take these scripts and knock them out of the park. So instead of, you know, other anthologies where the writer and the artist have to find each other and like make a script and submit it, I got scripts that I liked, and then I got artists that I liked, and I married the artist to the script that I thought they could draw the best. And that ended up working out really well because, and this is probably a very biased opinion, but I think we have some amazing looking, beautiful pages in this book. And the artists that we ended up assigning to each script, each one of them, as I was getting pages back as the editor and some, you know, as the writer for some of these stories too, I was just blown away by what they were submitting to me and what they were showing me. And even now we have some pages coming in for book two, which we're working on. We're already working on book two of the series. I'm getting pages back, and every time I'm like, wow, this is amazing. I'm so glad I chose to have other people come in and work on this with me rather than just me do it all by myself. Because again, it would never be published if I did that myself.
You know? Now, let me ask you, you have multiple artists, multiple writers. Like, is it like, do you try to keep a style, like as far as art or drawing, or is that kind of the allure to it that every story or pictures are different and written differently? Like, or is there kind of like a guideline that both the writers and the artists need to follow to kind of make it all fit together?
Not at all. I purposefully chose artists for the first book and for each book that don't look similar, because the stories take place throughout time, and things that happen and look and read today is not how it was 100 years ago.
Right.
So I wanted to make sure that the voices in the book, the scripts that we got, and the visuals of the book stood out for each story. So we have each story has a different, almost a completely different style of artwork to go. It was, one of the great things about me being able to go out and find artists for all these scripts was, one, I have scripts written by people from all around the world, of all walks of life, of all backgrounds, which gives a very eclectic view of things. And then I have artists coming in from around the world that bring their view into these scripts. So we end up with this great hodgepodge of views from around the world that come together, that if you read the whole book in its entirety, there actually is a whole story that connects all the short stories in the book. That's and cool, the synergy in it ended up being really good in the final product.
Wow. Hey, that's fascinating. No, and let me ask, when you're such a big fan of horror and you have this vision, and obviously you have in your mind this world, is it hard to, when people have ideas that maybe you don't initially find as horror scary, to kind of warm up to it, where they have to explain out the story? Or did you already have an idea for the wide variety you were looking for?
So I had an idea for the overarching story that I wanted to do, because what we ended up doing about a year ago, we broke the big book into 4 smaller books. So each book is about 64 to 78 pages in size, and then there's going to be 4 volumes of these stories. And I built the idea of what the overarching story is for each book, and then what the overarching story is for all 4 books together, because the 4 books together tell one large story, and each book tells a smaller story for itself, and then each story inside that book tells its own story. But with the writers who wrote the shorter stories that, you know, weren't myself, they had pretty much full creative control to tell the story in their way. And the only guidelines I gave them were very simple. Just, you know, here's the outline of how the family is. Here's the outline of how the monsters are. Connect them in whatever way you want to see. And give me, you know, they gave me a pitch. As long as your pitch fits into this world that I have, you know, we're gonna roll with it if I think it's gonna be good enough for this book and mend well with the other stories. Now, I do have some writers who come to me like, hey, what about this bigger story? And as a writer and creator, sometimes I'm like, oh, that's not necessarily horror. That's not necessarily something I was thinking about. But I always try to like look at it objectively, like, okay, even though it's not necessarily horror, could it fit into a horror book? Because some of the best ways to do a larger horror story is to have elements in it that don't necessarily fall into that horror, but then help build you into something else that does have that scary element to it. Because the calm before the storm usually makes the storm better. Nope. So with the writers and many other stuff, I definitely worked in other stuff like that. Like in one of the future books we're having, we actually have a comedy story that is done as a radio play that is going to be taking place in book after book two. And it fits in because it takes elements of all the other stories and brings them forward into this comedic light. And then it comes out of that into what comes out of it ends up being like a big reveal coming from it through comedy and out of the comedy into back into seriousness. But melding those different voices and the different styles was definitely a challenge for this book and definitely a challenge for me to like, I'm a control freak on things. If you haven't picked that up yet by me picking everything in the book, but letting go of some of the elements of how the creators made the stories has ended up paying off well, forcing myself to step back and be more of the editor versus more of like telling everybody what to do has ended up giving us better stories.
I mean, it's very interesting. Like when you're talking, a couple things are like, coming to my mind as far as like projects and things like that. I've heard of people doing with kind of this interpretive, people lending in, you know, their own views on things. Like I'm thinking of there was a band called Sound of Animal Fighting where it was like a super band of a bunch of like different punk bands and all, but a lot of the guys weren't allowed to hear the other person's part of the song and they kind of put it all together at the end. And then I was thinking of Chuck Palahniuk, who wrote Haunted, how each chapter was a different, completely different story and within one novel. And then I was also thinking of a band that I'm big fan of was Coheed and Cambria with their big giant universe that they write all their songs within and comics within. So it's pretty cool because it reminds me of a couple things that I already like, and it sounds like, you know, it is a daunting task to try to put this all together. I was just wondering what are your like influences like going in. Like I know you said you were very big into the monsters and the comics and whatnot, but do you have any like artists or influences that you are helping you kind of put this piece together?
Like artists that influence me to put it together, or artists that are actually helping me put it together?
I guess both. I guess like artists that influence you that you're kind of, you know, basing some of your work off of or also, yeah, and artists that are helping you currently.
Cool. Yeah, it's a good question. So artists that have influenced me over the years kind of helped me develop my style, like how I do things. Growing up, I was a big fan of Boris Vallejo and Julie Bell and like those fantasy type painters. Like, you know, my most favorite paintings of all time is Frank Frazetta's Death Dealer. It's just, it's a beautiful painting. It's so simple. It's kind of, and those tones he gets in there is just so great. And going into the comic realm, you know, I grew up idolizing people like Carl Kessel and Jim Lee. And you know, I was a big Todd McFarlane fan with all the detail work they did. And then, you know, going back further, like Jim Aparo on his Batman stuff, and Neil Adams when he brought Batman out of the goofiness and back into the more serious detective stuff and told some more like darker stories back in the 70s, I was a big fan of that, those as well. And then I don't know any of the artist's name off the top of my head from it, but I was a big fan of what they did in Epic Illustrated, because they used to tell very serious, more fantasy horror type stories in that magazine. But I read this as a kid, and I was influenced highly by those, because I was like, I started comics reading as like Batman and Wolverine, like most kids do in the 80s and 90s. But then I quickly went into reading those, but also drifting towards heavy metal and towards epic and towards these anthology magazines that kind of give you lots of shorter stories, lots of more adult type stories. And to a 14-year-old kid, reading epic and heavy metal was a big deal.
Right.
And then reading Judge Dredd and like seeing what was happening over on the British side of comics was a big influence to me too, because I grew up with, you know, 2000 AD was a lot of fun to get. It was hard to get as a kid, but when I got one, you know, I loved it. And anymore today, with artists today, you know, I've actually become friends with Carl Kessel and Ron Randall of Trekker and stuff, and I talk to them about ideas and stuff, and like, you know, I bounce things like, hey, is this a decent idea? Should I go forward with this? And like, I'll show them my artwork and my pages and stuff like that. And they'll give me ideas on that. And like, I've become friends with Stefan Frank, who is the creator of a comic book called Silver, which is about Dracula. And it's, if you haven't read Silver, it's a beautiful comic that he has 4 volumes out now. But he's also the animation director from The Iron Giant. He does animation as well. And I had dinner with him last year at after Emerald City Comic Con, and we're sitting there, and she's showing me pages from an upcoming issue of Silver, and I'm showing him pages from this book here, and we're kind of like talking over compositions and stuff like that. And that was a huge help, because he gave me a bunch of ideas of how to form pages. Because if you ever read one of his books, like Silver, it reads like you're watching a movie, because you know he's a director, he's an animation director, and it the way he paces things, he was able to, like, when I talked to him about this book and showed him some pages, he was able to say, okay, this is, I like the way you're moving with this here, but think about this kind of stuff. And it helped me with, like, developing some pacing stuff from somebody who's been doing it professionally for years, stuff like that.
Right.
Interesting. As I'm looking over all the different stories and what's coming up in the anthology, I see some of them you've written them, some of them you've done ink, some of them you've done color. I even see, I'm guessing related, Kaylee, or say doing letters on one of the stories. Did you go into these with a plan for, I want to do this part of the story, I want to do that, or did it just come about where you're like, ooh, I want to tackle this part?
It was just more of, I just did the stuff that needed to be done. The Black Hand one that I did the inks over Greg Warrenchak, that just happened to be that we needed an inker, and I was like, well, I've done inking before, I'll ink that one, no big deal. And then I colored the Scott Godleski one for Nancy Ines, and that one I did want to color. I took that one on myself because I'm a big fan of Scott's. He does Copperhead. He's drawn Batwoman and Superman and Green Lantern and stuff like that. And when he came onto the book, I was like, I'm going to color this story because I just have to color his inks and stuff. But the other ones, it was just, I kind of filled myself in wherever we needed a spot. I wrote a bunch of scripts for this, and I have a co-editor, Casey Allen, on this book, and him and I both went through the process of, finding out and figuring out which stories best fit the first book. And it just happened that 2 of the ones I wrote end up in the first book. And, if you go through all the 30 some stories we have written and worked on, and a lot of them are done, I've done pencils, inks, colors, letters, written some of them throughout all of them. But, it's all about what's best for the book and what's best to fit in for the storyline. And, if something needs to be done, I've got the skills, for the most part, to do anything in this book they can do. So I just pick it up and do it.
So what are the plans for this book? Like people who are just hearing this now, or even just, came across you on the internet or whatnot. So what are the plans for this book? Is this a hard copy thing? When is this expected to be out? How can they get it? Where should they go?
So you can go to Ines Anthology, that's EYNES, anthology.com/Kickstarter. It's going to be on Kickstarter for the month of February of 2019. And it's going to be there. It's going to be it starts out as a soft cover book. If we hit our stretch goal, it's going to become a hardcover. I've already got that worked out with the printer, which is I hope it does, because the hardcover book is going to look beautiful because they do a fantastic job. We've partnered up with Kraken Print for printing, and they're handling all of our printing and getting the books to us all printed in the USA and shipped over to where I'm at, so I can then ship them out to everybody who backs the book. So it's going to be available there after the campaign ends. So come March, April time, it'll be available on the website, the IonsAnthology.com website. It'll be available in select comic book stores in the Northwest. And then I'm in talks with the distributor to get it out to other stores,
right,
across the U.S. comic stores. That's just it's a long process that signed up and get to go. And we got to make sure we get enough books in to distribute them out. Then also, I'll be at cons all next year or so, promoting this book after it goes, assuming it funds and it gets printed out.
Interesting. Now, also on the side, I see you have a couple of podcasts that you do, just like us. Why don't you tell us a little about the Haphazard Adventures and Spoiler Country?
Oh, sure. So Haphazard Adventures is a podcast I started back in 2009 with my wife. As you mentioned earlier, Kaylee, the letterist on the one story, that's my wife. She's doing calligraphy on that story, she has beautiful work. But in 2009, I decided I wanted to do a podcast where I just talked to webcomic creators. And we started doing that, webcomic creators. And then later on, we kind of rebranded it to be just us talking about whatever, our kids, our family. We go to a lot of concerts and events, so we kind of like do concert event shows. It really is just a way for her and I to sit and talk and kind of rant as adults without kids around. It's a lot of fun. Now, Spoiler Country is a show I started up back in 2017 with actually my wife's uncle, Kenrick Regan, who's a writer on this book. He wrote Nancy Hines, Krampus Killer. He's a big comic fan like I am. We are close to the same age. He's only about a couple years older than me. We decided to start a podcast talking about comics and pop culture and movies and all the kind of nerdy stuff we love. And that podcast has actually taken us, to San Diego and to Portland and to San Francisco to various conventions to cover and do all this kind of fun stuff. We've had people on like Richard Cadry and Uwe Boll, and other creators have come on. And we do Kickstarter booths on there as well. Like, I'll bring on creators who have Kickstarters active, and we'll talk to them about what they're doing and try and have our listeners go back to their projects, stuff like that. And the podcast is a lot of fun. And that podcast actually turned into and has added on a YouTube show we do called Drinks and Comics, where we make a drink and talk about the drink we make, and then talk about a comic book or a movie or something like that on YouTube.
Nice. That's awesome, man. So if people do want to go check you out and go see, follow you on Instagram, follow the Einsontology, where's the best place to go kind of get a good look and insight into what the project actually is?
So if you want to see the project, I would say the best thing to do is one or two things. Either if you're big on Instagram, go to Instagram and just search for Einsontology, or just at Einsontology there. You'll see process stuff. We have some little videos of the artist drawing stuff. We have a bunch of the sample art there. You can also see it all on the website, ionsanthology.com. We have an entire section set up for book one where you can see all the stories in book one, all the creators in book one, get a sample page from each story, kind of see what the art looks like for each story, and kind of learn about who created the stories and what they're doing, what else they've done. If you're interested in finding more about me, I am everywhere on social media, just Y2CL, four characters. Or you can go to y2cl.net, and that's kind of like my main website where I have – so I need to update it. It's out of date, I'll be honest. But I'm most active on Twitter. That's where I spend all my time. If you want to see more of my artwork, you can go to Instagram. I post a lot of art there, of stuff outside of Ions that I've done and do. But that's pretty much where I'm at online.
Awesome.
Interesting. Now, let me ask you. It's been really interesting talking to you about your passion and all the things you love about comics and horror, but I got to know, as a person who's passionate about stuff, what is the worst comic book character and what is the worst horror villain out there, in your opinion?
Oh, man. So the worst comic book character, if you would have asked me this question like 8 years ago, I would have said Deadpool, because I thought he was way overrated and stupid. But I kind of like him now, so I can't use that word anymore.
Damn Ryan Reynolds.
Right, damn you, Ryan Reynolds, for making me like something.
See, I'm not a comic book guy, and the one comic I liked was Deadpool growing up. Like, I kind of got into it.
See, I always thought he was overrated, and there was a couple series in the 90s I thought were kind of decent of his, but for the most part, I was like, man, why is this guy so popular? But then the movie came out and all this stuff. I'm like, okay, I get it. I get it now. It's cool. But probably the worst one that I don't care for, that's a tough one. Because every time I answer this question, I always think of reasons why I should like that character, because I don't really get Squirrel Girl too much, to be honest, but that's because I never read Squirrel Girl. So I don't, I can say that because I never read it. But then again, I've also never given her a chance. So
just you saying that, I'm agreeing. I'm like, yep, Squirrel Girl.
But, some people really love her. I just don't get it,
I think that girl from the AT&T commercials is going to play her in either a TV show or movie or something like that.
Yeah, she's playing on the New Mutants show that will someday come out. But, I mean, maybe I'll like it then. I don't know. Like, the whole idea of a girl with unlimited squirrels, I just don't understand, I guess.
Oh, my God. That sounds horrific. But
right.
That's awesome.
And then,
go ahead.
The other one was most overrated horror villain, you said?
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm gonna have to go with Chucky because I don't like the Chucky movies, and I don't know. I just don't care for the whole killer toy thing. It's not my bag for horror. I mean, I've watched most of them, and I actually found Bride of Chucky kind of funny and kind of quirky. But for the most part, I don't really care for Chucky.
For those who do like Chucky, we interviewed Alex Vincent. He played
of course.
To that episode, but.
And if you like Chucky, I am also very gingery. So But, John, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your story. And good luck with the project, man. It sounds like a very large undertaking, but it sounds like your heart's in it, and that's definitely the first place to start. So I hope it's a mass success, and keep it going, man.
I hope so too, man. I have many plans for this storyline if it goes through. So
yeah, I'm always fascinated. I know I've said this on the podcast several times, and even last week when I did John Fratelli without you, I'm very fascinated by the writing process of people, whether it's comics, whether it's, you know, comic book artists, authors, like when we talked to Jennifer Keeshan Armstrong. I just love that, you know, there's so many trails to get to one point, you know, but there's a million ways to get there, you know, like there's, you know, like some people are pen to paper, some people are you know, go work it out on stage if you're a comic. Some musicians are able to write it all on paper. Some musicians jam it out together with a band. So I'm always fascinated by the writing process of, like, creative people.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a different thing, you know. That's why it's always funny when, like, quote-unquote teachers are like, no, you can't act like – you can't listen to music while you're trying to do this. That's not the process of art.
Right.
How dare you?
But yeah, so the Ions Anthology. All right. Pretty cool concept there. Sounds like a huge undertaking, like relying on like many artists, many writers, it's a very big undertaking, very, very hard for me to wrap my head around.
Yeah, it's a lot to tackle and on. I mean, you see how dedicated he is with the different storylines and characters and stuff like that he has in his mind. So, you know, we wish John the best of luck, and hopefully the Kickstarter will get moving, and we can hear more from him and come back on the show.
That's it. That's a perfect segue, Michael Berlow, into some bear news.
Ooh.
We're talking about bear and shit. We're talking about bear and shit. It's freaking bear news. Bears in the world doing all sorts of things. Yeah, girl. You know I like them bears and shit.
What was that sound?
It's like the background. I don't know all the lyrics, right? It's kind of like when you're in church, you're like,
you're mouthing the lyrics.
Yeah,
I don't even think you got one word out. I think you literally just went, but all right, so we have not done bear news. I don't even remember the last time we did it. Been quite a while. Every once in a while, we do a little bit here where we look up some of the latest, the hottest news in the bear world, Berlew.
I mean, it's going 24/7, Scotty. You know, you're still working on that bear news network. You know, I can't wait for it to come out in my next cable package.
That bear news cycle is intense. But let's start down by you in North Carolina. North Carolina, how far?
That's a little higher up than me, but okay.
It's not that far. It's closer to you than me.
I think it's closer to the same. It depends on the area. Like Charlotte, I think that's about 6 to 8 hours for me.
Anyway, hunter treated after finding the first rabid black bear in North Carolina. Okay. The first rabid black bear. The Hyde County, North Carolina hunter who found a bear dying of rabies has now been treated for exposure to the disease. Johnny Dale, who owns a hunting guide company in the rural coastal area, told the newspaper that he had been treated for rabies after touching the dead bear. The North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission said last week that Dale found the rabid black bear in the middle of December. Dale reported that he first observed the male bear the day before his game feeder and that it was alive but very lethargic and unable to move. Dale went back the next day and the bear was dead. Rabies in wild black bears is extremely rare. It's been documented only 4 times in the lower 48 states since 1999. Colleen Olfenbuttel, Colleen, you know her.
Big fan of the show.
Yeah. Oh, it's Colleen Openbottle.
Shout out to Collies.
A biologist with the condition said, in press release, you can only get rabies by coming in direct contact with the saliva, tears, or brain or nervous system of an infected animal. So he said, I had a rabies vaccine in the arm, 2 antibiotic injections in the hip, and 2 in my butt. They said I would have to come back in a few weeks for a rabies vaccine booster, and 2 weeks later for another booster. So, North Carolina. Yeah, go ahead.
So, I'm just kind of curious. Did he touch the dead bear's saliva, tears, or brain matter?
I don't know, but Mike, here's some tips that maybe you can use if you come in contact with a dead bear.
Well, that's good to know. Go ahead. That happens all the time.
North Carolina wildlife officials caution hunters about properly handling bears and any other animals they come into contact with. So do not handle or eat any animal that is acting abnormal or appears to be sick. So, Mike, next time you see a dead bear, please don't run up to it and start gnawing on its hindquarters.
Now, Scott, can I do a selfie with a dead bear? Will that give me rabies?
I mean, you could try. Why not? And then you could just do selfies at the rabies clinic.
As long as I don't kiss him and get it saliva, I'll be good for my selfies. All right, continue.
Wear latex or rubber gloves when field dressing. Never handle a dead animal with your bare hands. Minimize the handling of the brain and spinal cord. Do not allow pets around your field dressing area to prevent contact with saliva, blood, and other tissues. Wash hands, boots, and instruments thoroughly after field dressing is completed. If a deer or a bear is commercially processed, request that the animal be processed individually without meat from other animals and use proper cooking temperatures to ensure a safe food.
Yeah. See, when a bear's chasing you, what's really scary is when you realize, oh, my God, I don't have gloves on. That's the scariest thing that can happen to a human being. So please, if you're running for your life, make sure you put on them gloves. Be safe.
I remember, like, when we were kids, I used to hear about rabies a whole lot more than I hear about it now. I don't know. Like, I feel like back in the day, everybody's like, you're going to get rabies. Like, watch out for – I also feel like there was a lot more, like, neighborhood dogs just – strangely walking around the neighborhood where I lived. Like,
yeah, I mean, that was like a running joke on like TV shows or cartoons. Like a dog would get into like shaving cream or something, and somebody would be like, oh, he's got rabies, and run out of the room or something like that.
That's what I mean. I feel like rabies was a lot like, we was like, oh, you got rabies, like we joke about it and stuff. I don't see that too much anymore. I don't even hear rabies anymore, besides, you know, getting the dog rabies vaccine or whatever. But, yeah, a lot of neighborhood dogs back in the day. Like, I remember playing basketball at the park, and they'll be like, oh, crap, there's Smokey, the German Shepherd, and, yeah, stay away from, like, he looks crazy. He just roams around the neighborhood, and we just be like, eh, whatever.
Old Smokey, the retriever. Don't bother me, kids. Don't come over me. I'll give you rabies.
Speaking of Smokey, Mike, let's get to the second story.
All right.
Autopsy shows Smokey Mountain visitor died of a drug overdose and not a bear attack. Okay.
Ooh.
So the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee, officials recently received the autopsy report from the Knox County Regional Forensic Center detailing William Lee Hill died of an accidental methamphetamine intoxication, age 30, in Louisville, Tennessee. He was found off trail in the park on Sunday. Okay. Now, according to the report, the autopsy revealed extensive postmortem animal predation, but no findings of antemortem or paramortem trauma. So, i.e., Mr. Hill was not attacked by the bear. At the time of the discovery, researchers encountered a bear feeding on Hill's body. Without knowing the definitive cause of death, the next day officials made the decision to euthanize the bear in interest of public safety after consultation with wildlife professionals and further understanding the bear's aggressive behavior. The roading leading into the area closed to the public while the bear was located and euthanized a few days later. The park is home to an estimated 1,500 bears. Very few bears exhibit aggressive behavior towards humans. This is kind of sad, you know, both ways.
I mean, there was a moment in time there where when he passed away, like, everybody was sad, but, like, damn, he went out badass. You
right.
know,
right.
He was fighting a bear. Like, people were just imagining this guy just like punching a bear in the face. It's like, I'm going down, you're going down with me, and all this scenes. And then it's just like, oh, Jimmy likes his meth.
Yeah, another over to, you know, it stinks the bear's got to get shot in the head, too. So his drug problem really killed two things himself, yeah. You know. Bear's just being opportunistic and eating the big slab of meat that's there. I wonder if the bear got high.
I mean, what would be a scarier scenario? A rabid bear coming after you or a bear on meth coming after you?
I don't know. Do we have anybody from Florida we can call real quick? Because I feel like that just...
I'm sure it's Zeke, you're on the air. I know the answer to that. It was Tuesday. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I
the bear mauled out his teeth. No, that was the meth.
Yeah.
Sorry. Kids, remember, say no to drugs or we'll murder wildlife because of you.
Yeah, the bear, you know, it kind of sucks, but, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, you know, I remember I told the story a couple months ago. I saw we saw a guy that was, we were walking in the woods and we saw some guy just sleeping at the picnic table. We're like, oh, he's just taking a nap. And we went all the way around the loop, like an hour and a half walk, and he was still there. I'm like, uh-oh. And we saw a bunch of cops there, and you hear someone say, oh, get the Narcan. So similar situation. This guy definitely OD'd, and I don't know if he made it, but I didn't see him getting eaten by a bear, though.
Yeah. The cops had the plate safe, and they went out and shot one regardless. You know, you can never be too careful in this world.
So finally, Ozzy, okay, I think we, years ago, we checked in with this bear. Ozzy the Grizzly Bear predicts the Patriots to win the Super Bowl.
How'd that turn out?
Ozzy the 680-pound grizzly bear ate part of a watermelon cake with the New England Patriots logo on a Tuesday morning at Zoo Montana, meaning the animal predicted the team to win the Super Bowl. Zoo Montana has recorded Ozzy's predictive eating tendencies for 7 years now. Berlo, what do you think his record is?
7 years, I'm going to say 5-2.
With the Patriots win, he is 6-1.
Woo!
So, Damn. Solid bear. Solid bear pick. And predicting the Super Bowl winner by eating the right piece of food when faced with treats labeled for each team. Ozzy's only incorrect pick was the Broncos over the Seahawks in 2014. The bear has now had a chance to pick for or against the New England Patriots three times and has chosen them every single time. Smart bear. Smart bear right there. It's like my rule. I don't bet against the Patriots. It's just a rule.
Do you recall, I'm not sure they still have these shows where, like, bookies have shows that are like, call my hotline. I'll give you the best spreads of this weekend and all. Yeah. I got a great deal. And I just see, you know. Call my number. No, Austin Bear right here. No, he likes the brands tonight. Which cake he's going to eat, though? Is it going to be over or under? Call Ozzy for his cake exploration.
It'd be great if he was like, you know, like he ran the season like 15-2 or something like that every Monday night. So Ozzy has never had a chance to pick the Los Angeles Rams. This was the first time the team formerly known as St. Louis had made the Super Bowl since Ozzy's been picking. This year, Ozzy was presented with cakes made of watermelon, topped with whipped cream, strawberries, and grapes. In years past, he was offered banana cakes, but the grizzly was not quick to partake last year, prompting the change in food. Typically, the bear eats pounds of fruits, vegetables, and bear kibble multiple times a day. The bear does not have as much of an appetite for meat, he said. So Uwilt and the zoo staff set up two boxes topped with cakes outside of a small door Ozzy can take into a small fenced roofed enclosure adjacent to the larger outdoor enclosure. Each cake was stuck with sugar paper label.
Oh.
depicting either the Rams or Patriots logo. The bear initially seemed disinterested in the entire endeavor. But then around 8:10, he made his way and ate the Patriots cake.
Can you imagine that year? Like, this baker made this, like, banana cake for the Super Bowl, and some guys got to go up to him. Yeah, listen, I know you spent like 3 hours on each cake, but Ozzy's not digging the banana. we're going to need you to do two new cakes and all. I mean, what else you got? And watermelon? Yeah, that seems like an Ozzy flavor. No, let's go with that.
We're going to be taking our business somewhere else.
Yeah.
You're just not you're not appealing to Ozzy's wants and needs, and frankly, we're going to have to let you go.
But Totally Sweets has been the official Ozzy sponsor for the last 5 years. You can't do this to me.
See, I like that they said he was initially unfazed. Like, I picture all these gambling addicts, like, waiting by the bear cage. It's like, come on! Like, with their bookie on hold. Or like
some mafia guy with a baseball bat. I wouldn't touch that Rams cake if I were you. Wouldn't do it, Ozzy. I'm smarter than the average bear, and I could kick its ass.
So, Ozzy seems to be a reliable source, man. 6-1 for Ozzy the Bear. And that there, everybody, is Bear News.
Bear News. We're talking about bear and shit. We're talking about bear and shit. It's freaking Bear News. Bears in the world doing all sorts of things. Yeah, girl. You know I like them bears and shit.
You sound like Buffalo Bill.
I am? I don't even know what he sounds like, but good for me.
Wasn't that his name in Silence of the Lambs?
Oh, Silence of the Lambs? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I
didn't know I was going for one, but
put the
lotion
in the box, you know, in the basket. Yeah.
Put the lotion in the basket and bear news and talk about bear shit.
All right, bro. But what do you got before we get the hell out of here?
I'm noticing, Scott, I got a weird obsessive compulsive item that I've done like 5 or 6 times. I just want to kind of talk with you about it. I'm noticing in work, and I do this at home, if somebody throws ice in the sink, I have to turn on the faucet and melt every single ice cube until it's gone.
Stop.
Yeah.
Wait. Now, this is such a strange thing, because how often does that happen?
At work, I've seen it a couple of times where I see it, I'm like, I've got to melt it, and... And I do notice, like, if I drink something and I pour the ice in the sink, like, I'll take, like, a couple steps away, and I'm like, no, gotta melt it. I gotta turn on the sink, pour the water. If it's not reaching the ice cubes, I gotta take out the hose so I can spray it directly.
Wow.
So I melt all the ice. Like, it's not a subconscious thing where it's like, if I don't do it, like, bad things will happen, but I can't just walk away from it. I have to do it.
That's weird, man. Like, what kind of feelings are coming up? So, okay, let's say you're at work, typing away, you're doing whatever you got to do, and all of a sudden you hear in the eye and you sink behind you or whatever. What emotions?
Well, I don't hear it. It's like, okay. I'll go into the break room, and I'll make a tea or get a glass of water. As I pass by the sink, I'll notice there's ice in there. And I guess it's almost like a fun game to me, where it's like, yay, I got rid of them all. I cleared the level, for lack of a better term.
So, like, ice also doesn't, like, melt right away either underwater. You know, it takes a few minutes. So you're just sitting there watching the ice go. Now, when did you realize that this was a problem? Like, that you have this obsessive compulsive kind of behavior, or did someone point this out to you?
It's just something I noticed and all, because, like, I think it was a couple days ago. Like, the company had a Super Bowl party for us, and they did a really good job. They got us a ton of wings and sandwiches and all that, and like, I went back into there, I'm like, see if there's any wings left, and I noticed there was ice in the sink, and I'm just kind of looking at it, I'm like, I gotta do this, and all. And it's just, there's just some kind of happy feeling I get when and get rid of all the ice in the sink.
Well, I mean, it's a little I'm picturing you like standing by the ice, like staring very intently into the sink until it's all gone. Now, if you were to be separated from that ice that was like half melted, like they're like, Mike, get back to work. You got to go. You got a phone call. Would you feel uneasy?
I don't think I'd feel uneasy, but I would probably make a second trip after I was done just to finish the job if it was still in there. It's just something I feel like I would say it's more, I feel fun by doing it, and I can't explain why, but it's just a feeling I get where the second I see it, it's like, game on.
Now that
we're getting rid of this ice.
Now that you like address this issue, does it bring up like any, do you remember enjoying doing this when you were a kid or anything? Or do you remember like doing this in the past?
I'm trying to think. I do remember at some point, I remember coming across this thing where it was like half full of ice for some reason. Like somebody just like finally cleaned out the freezer and there was like large chunks in there. And I just went to town, for lack of a better term. It's just like, I'll get it. And
well,
I mean, it's not like I'm going around saying, guys, look what I did. It's just something, it just almost gives me euphoria, if you will, to take care of it.
I think that's like number one sign of a serial killer. I'm pretty sure that was on the list.
Ice melting?
I tried while you were talking, tried to like Google if anybody has this, you know, similar things. The only thing I could find is, now your symptoms don't seem to match this, but pagophobia, which is the fear, okay, the fear of ice or frost.
I don't fear it.
Right.
I almost take it like a game where it's like the more ice is in there, it's like, all right, let's see how fast we can take care of this.
Well, like, yeah, like, so the phobia, the symptoms are, by person depend on their level of fear. The symptoms typically include extreme anxiety, dread, or anything associated with panic, such as shortness of breath, rapid breathing, irregular heartbeat, sweating, excessive sweating, nausea, dry mouth, and shaking.
Nope, don't have that. Just euphoria.
Like
a sense of an accomplishment for no good reason other than there's no longer ice in the sink.
I know how I would, like, you know, mess with you. Like, I would love to get in your house and just fill your sinks with ice, fill, like, buckets and, like...
Like, you would, like, put the stopper in the sink and, like, turn off all the heat and let me come back from vacation. Oh, my God!
I mean, yeah, that's a little weird, buddy. That's like, that's new for you. When did you realize it? Like, when did you realize that you had multiple issues with this?
I won't say it was like issues or anything, but like I said, I just like after like it did the last time, I just sat back and I said to myself, man, that happens every time I see ice in the sink. I have to take care of this and all.
Well, I mean, at least it's a cheap entertainment for you. Like, you don't have to really, you know.
Scott, I put $30,000 in ice last month, man. Every time I'm like, this is my last 5-pound bag. I swear.
Dude, I Google, you could generally find anything. I can't find, I put obsession with melting ice, love of melting ice. Just can't seem to find anything.
I broke the internet.
You might be like your own person.
That should be a poll on verbal shenanigans. Do you like melting ice in your sink?
Yeah. A, yes. B, no. C, what the hell are you talking about? Well, yeah. I mean, that's, speaking of like fears or kind of obsessions or whatever, I've been very anxious the last 3 weeks. I haven't been to the dentist in a long time, and I'm finally going tomorrow. I wanted to get it done before the wedding, and just in general, I felt like for a while now, I gotta go. I need to go.
Anything in particular, or just your overdue yearly checkup?
Just overdue checkups.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. And I take care of my teeth. I mean, I brush my teeth or whatever twice a day, and there's nothing really in pain. But I had a million traumatic teeth experiences as a kid, knocked teeth out, had a dentist that I hated, and he didn't touch me or anything, but like he, you know, just I was broke my teeth like 7 times, like a bunch of things. So I think I just hate the dentist so much that I was just eventually like, I don't need to go. I don't need to go. I don't do that. I don't go. But now I'm forcing myself to go to the dentist, and I'm not happy about it.
Is this a dentist that you know, or are you going to a totally new person?
I'm going brand new. I asked someone I work with, like, who do you go to? And she recommended this person, and I'm just going and taking her recommendation.
So are you feeling like angst, like when they ask you the question, so who's your regular dentist, or when was the last time you seen a doctor before?
A little bit. Like, they send you, like, she sent me, like, the pre-paperwork or whatever. Like, she's like, I'll fill it out so it'll be quicker when we get it. And, like, it's like, who's your primary physician? I don't have a primary physician. When's the last time you went to the doctor? I don't ever go to the doctor. So not great. Not great feeling right now. Do you go to dentist?
Do you feel you should, like, give one of your comedian friends, put their number down, and just say, when this person calls, just say you're a dentist?
Are you?
Dr. Bumper Car, DDS, how can I help you?
Do you go to the dentist every year?
Not every year. I try to at least do it on like a 1.5-2 year basis. I mean, I'm equivalent when I'm bad at stuff. Like, I'm going to the eye doctor tomorrow because been having some issues. When I've been going to work, the sun has been coming, like, literally, like, even with the roads and all, where you're just totally blind. And I'm noticing, like, when I'm going to work, I'm having more, like, I don't know what they call it, flares or glares, but basically it takes a lot longer for one of my eyes to kind of
focus
on the screen. So want to take a look at that.
Yeah, and I've been having I said I got to go to the eye doctor, too. I've been having problem with lights at night, like seeing like kind of like halos around lights at night. So, I don't know. So maybe my vision is finally going a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, but I'm kind of the same way. Like when I get contacts, which are only supposed to last a year, it's usually 2 or 3. They actually last.
They're probably gonna they're gonna be like, that's why you that's why your eyes can't focus.
Well, you won't have to worry about coming here anymore because you're blind. Good work there, Berlou. Doctor, does that mean I can never see ice in the sink again?
you're gonna have to feel it from now on.
Honey, that's just a cold plate. It felt like ice.
Do you? I was thinking about this the other day. If God forbid, what like you ever had to lose a sense, like if you had to get rid of one, what could you live with? I could never live without sight. That's frightening to me.
I mean, that's a frightening thing. My dad went without taste for like 9 months, and he was in pure misery. So I got that, and all the backstory for that was my dad was not to go back to my old routine when I did stand up, but my dad was born with a messed up eardrum, and after many years, one of the doctors said, you know, he looked at the eardrum, it was basically malformed, and he said, you know, we can do a surgery and you'll finally be able to hear with both ears. So my dad was all for it, and it's really depressing. Basically, he had the surgery, he was able to hear clearly in both ears for 2 days, then it went away, then it took his sense of taste.
Jeez. Yuck.
And he was a miserable man for quite a while. Like, I remember my mom would tell me stories. She'd be like, well, what do you want to eat tonight? He's like, what does it matter? You can give me cardboard. It don't matter. And all, he was just so depressed about it. It took a long time to bring back. Like, if he had to keep on eating, like, really spicy foods just to get any kind of sensation for a while. And then he finally got it back, like I said, like, close to a year after the surgery.
And the hearing never came back?
Hearing never came back. Huh. You know, I mean, he still's got the one ear, but he's like, nah, I'm not going to chance it again, because like, he was just so depressed. And it's not only that that happened, but the fact that he had it for 2 days, and then it's like,
Nope. Dad, since you can't taste, can I interest you in some melted ice?
I made it myself. Right in the sink, fresh.
Dad, I hear melted ice is the cure to all ailments.
Danny boy, get out of my sink. My hot water heater can't take all that melting.
How come we never have any ice cubes in this house? Flash to you in the basement, creepily melting ice.
Yes, melt. What are you doing down there? Playing myself.
Melt. Magnifying glass.
I'm going to end up being one of them super villains. Is like, I'm going to use a heat ray on Antarctica and melt it all.
I'm definitely going to try to Photoshop you trying to melt Antarctica.
Superman.
The world's slowest superhero. We're getting there.
Maybe you should use something more than a magnifying glass, Mike.
Rise, oceans, rise.
Damn, Aquaman 2 sucks.
It's so long.
Man.
Melted ice. Burlo, let's get out of here. What the hell you got to promote?
I'll promote a couple of buddies of ours, the SNL nerds, Darren Patterson and John Trumbull. They do a weekly podcast where they review the previous week's SNL episodes and also go back to some of the past things that go over best things. This week they did best athletes that hosted SNL, where I helped out and some suggestions on that. So check them out on your favorite podcast channels. They're a part of the Non-Productive Network. Their show is called SNL Nerds.
Yes. And I got to promote, I don't usually do much for my birthday. I'm not a big birthday spectacle guy. I usually go to a brewery or something like that. But this month happens to be my brewery. My birthday falls on the monthly Tap House 15 comedy show. So I'm doing something a little different. I am bringing seven of my good friends, good comic buddies, to do all 10-minute sets. No host, just passing the mic to the next person. Just try and have a very fun time. So I am bringing Joe Conte, Matt Jenkins, Joanne Filon, Jackie Byrne, KP Burke, and Natty Bumper Car. I think I got everybody to the show. So it should be a blast. And we're just going to kind of keep it real fun and loose and things like that. So I'm excited for that. And that's February 28th. It is free to come. It's a two-item minimum or whatnot. You're going to want a two-item minimum anyway from Tap House. Food and beer is delicious. And
if you don't use it, use your two items to buy Scott a drink.
Correct. The last show was freaking fantastic a couple days ago. So make your reservations February 28th. And that's it. So, guys... also, check us out. We got a couple new locations, I guess. A couple new places you can go listen to us. The Discover County Network. We're coming up on a new thing called Coming Right Up. We should be up there on February 15th. And then all your normal podcast platforms, we should be up and running. So we're happy to be part of all that fun stuff. So I guess that's it. Life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Adios.
Melt you later.